From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, we're revisiting some of our favorite author interviews of 2025. Suzanne Cope tells the untold stories of Italy's fearless female resistance fighters in Women of War. Spies, saboteurs, assassins, they risked everything to defy the Nazis. NPR journalist Emily Fang explores life under communist China in Let Only Red Flowers Bloom, bringing the human stories behind the headlines. Award-winning author Lori Gwynn Shapiro reveals the showman behind aviation legend Amelia Earhart, a side of the icon you've never heard. And best-selling cookbook author Allison Roman shares her new cookbook, Something from Nothing, and tells us about her Delaware County store first bloom. That's all coming up after this hour's news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Tensions are growing between Congress and the Justice Department over the release of documents tied to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The DOJ missed a deadline last Friday to release all of the files, instead posting them in batches over the past week. Now, Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna says lawmakers are prepared to escalate the pressure.
We would give the Attorney General a 30-day grace period to continue to release documents to be in compliance. And after those 30 days, there would start to be a $5,000 fine on her personally for the documents that she is not releasing. We also plan to go to the Southern District of New York, asking the judge who ordered these releases to have a special master see what should be redacted or not.
Lawmakers are now considering those options as they weigh how to hold the Justice Department accountable for the delayed release. New developments in a court battle between the government and housing providers. The case could force the Trump administration to fund permanent housing programs for the homeless for another year. Kelly Kinoyer of member station WHQR reports.
The case involves more than $3 billion in grant funding that helps house 170,000 disabled, elderly, and vulnerable Americans. The administration wants to take that grant funding and move it to transitional programs with expiration dates. But now, a federal judge has ordered the Department of Housing and Urban Development to maintain the status quo for renewing programs with its upcoming grant cycle. HUD still has the option to appeal to the Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Kinoyer.
Senior Libyan military officers, including the chief of staff and a general who led ground forces, died in a plane crash south of Ankara. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports officials in Turkey say all seven people on board were killed.
The Tripoli-based Libyan government says the military's chief of staff, Lieutenant General Mohammed al-Haddad, as well as two other top generals, an advisor and a military photographer, were killed in the plane crash. They'd been in Turkey for defense talks. Libya has two rival governments, with Turkey backing the government based in Tripoli. Turkey's interior minister says the private plane took off for Tripoli from Ankara just after 8 p.m. local time Tuesday. Turkish officials wrote on X the plane had requested an emergency landing after electrical faults, and that contact was lost around 40 minutes after takeoff. The Turkish interior minister says the plane's black box and cockpit voice recorder were recovered Wednesday, with an investigation ongoing alongside Libyan authorities. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits fell last week, remaining at historically healthy levels. The Labor Department says new jobless claims dropped by 10,000 to 214,000 for the week ending December 20th. This is NPR News. A jury has ordered Johnson & Johnson and its subsidiaries to pay $1.5 billion to a Baltimore woman after finding the company liable for exposing her to asbestos through baby powder. Scott Massioni from member station WYPR reports it's the largest win for a single person in a talc-related case.
The Baltimore Circuit Court jury found that the company knew that its baby powder products caused mesothelioma, an incurable form of cancer. Jessica Dean, an attorney on the case, says Johnson & Johnson consistently lied about the safety of the product.
The willingness to sacrifice future people's health, protect their pocketbook when they have unreal resources, is gross.
The company says it will appeal the $1.5 billion verdict. About 67,000 people are suing Johnson & Johnson over cancer diagnoses. The company moved from talc to cornstarch-based baby powder in the U.S. in 2020. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
A coalition of 19 states and Washington, D.C. is suing the Department of Health and Human Services over a declaration that could restrict access to gender-affirming care for minors. The declaration calls treatments like puberty blockers and hormone therapy unsafe and ineffective for young people experiencing gender dysmorphia. It also warned doctors they could lose access to federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid if they provide that type of care. Stocks are trading mixed on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow up 105 points, the Nasdaq down 6. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're bringing you some of our favorite author interviews of the past year. Author and narrative historian Suzanne Cope's new book, Women of War, The Italian Assassins, Spies, and Couriers Who Fought the Nazis, uncovers the extraordinary and, until now, largely untold stories of four courageous women who risked everything to resist fascism during World War II. From bomb-making in underground bunkers to cycling through the Alps with munitions strapped to their backs, these women fought not only against Nazi occupation and Mussolini's loyalists, but also against the erasure of their own legacies. Cope is also the author of Power Hungry, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and more. I spoke with her in May. First, what drew you to the Italian resistance during World War II, specifically the stories of these remarkable women?
Yeah, well, it turns out my grandmother, she was not one of the resistance members. She was Italian when she, as a child, she lived in Italy, but then she moved to the United States. But it turns out that she is the exact age of these women. And so when I just started doing exploratory work, I had found out about one woman who was part of the resistance as part of another research project. And I was doing more research to see what other stories were out there as I thought about my next book. It just hit me that my grandmother, who was so political and she really taught me about justice, and in a lot of ways, she led me towards this work, that she could have been one of them if she had stayed in Italy. And so that made it all the more personal to me.
And let's talk about some of those women, not your grandma, but these other four extraordinary women. Carla Capponi, Bianca Guidetti, Teresa Mattei, and Anita Malavasi. What made you choose these particular women to spotlight?
Yeah, well, I spent a summer a couple years ago, and there were so many amazing stories of women who were doing incredible things. They were delivering bombs, they were supporting and being part of these mountain brigades. They were writing underground newspapers. And so these four women represent kind of the breadth of the different experiences that the women had during the resistance. Of course, there are so many more stories than these. And so I liked that they were from four different places, that they did a variety of things so that we could see what kinds of acts that these amazing women did during the war. And then also, you know, as a historian, I need to have enough information to be able to tell their stories. So they all left behind testimonies or interviews. In two cases, they wrote books. And a couple of them were also married to people that they were partnered with during the war. And so their partners wrote books. So I was able to have all of these different kinds of resources to help really make the stories come alive, because that was really my goal on the page, is to have this be a narrative history, to feel like we were in the moment with them, but to make up absolutely nothing. So everything is true. Everything, even, you know, the emotions that these women felt, those were what they talked about during in their testimonies or on the page. And so it's a completely true story, but it's so evocative. And it was just such a pleasure to research and tell.
Each of them seem to represent a different geography and style of resistance that's also evocative. Is there a favorite story or defining moment from one of their lives that really stayed with you?
Oh my gosh. I know. It's like choosing a favorite child. you know, I do love all of their stories. I think There's a favorite story from each of them. I won't talk about all of them because you could read the book and read about it. One, I do think that Carla Capone's story in Rome was really wonderful because I could truly trace her steps all around Rome. I visited Rome multiple times during this research. And so to be able to see some of the places that, that she was spying to watch the Nazis and the fascists walk around, that was just so powerful to be able to walk in her footsteps. And I think what she did was incredibly brave. And then, you know, she escaped death a couple times in very close calls. I do have this soft spot for Anita Malavasi, and I spent some wonderful time in Reggio and talking to great archivists there. She was a staffetta, which was a courier around town. So she was delivering bombs and munitions and messages. And then she was almost caught. She was arrested and released and told to come back the next day. And so she knew that she had to escape into the mountains. And so in the mountains, she also realized that the person she was engaged to, that she didn't really love him. And so she broke up with him and she met someone else in the mountains. And so there's this wonderful love story. That's just this one small part of it. And it is somewhat tragic, but I loved being able to go into the mountains, and some of the archivists there have recreated the paths that these women took, like literally up and down ravines where they would go and bring messages and travel between different encampments. And so to be able to walk in those footsteps is really powerful. And I loved getting to know and tell Anita's story a little bit more, because the three other women had more visible lives after the war. Two of them were in government, but she was the one who was pretty well known in her region, but she wasn't as well known around Italy. And so I loved being able to tell her story.
Your book explores not only resistance, but also gender roles, feminist awakening during wartime, challenging traditional expectations. How do you see the legacy of these women resonating with today's movements for gender equality and social justice?
Oh, absolutely. When you think about the world that these women were coming out of, you know, through Mussolini's fascism, he was dictating what people could learn in school. So many, most people did not, these women, but also, you know, many other people their age, they lived pretty much their entire lives under Mussolini's authoritarian rule. And so they didn't really have a greater sense of history beyond what they were allowed to be taught. And so when they began to have this political education, which I think is so important for today for everybody, they saw this larger worldview. And so the fact that these women, especially because women in particular were taught to not be political, not have agency, to be wives, to be mothers. So for these women to really find this agency in this very short amount of time and build a movement, it's hard to think back and be like, wow, they really did this one step at a time. They did not walk into something that was fully created. They created it. And so for me, that's been so powerful and inspirational to think anything we want to do, this is how we begin a movement. We connect with people around us. We learn, we share what we've learned, and we just start to do what we can moving forward. And to see what they created in such a short amount of time is really amazing.
Did writing and researching this book change how you think about activism or resistance or courage?
You know, this book and also my last book, Power Hungry, I was so honored to be able to amplify the stories of these brave people. And it wasn't until somewhat recently when I felt, you know, kind of politically, like, what am I going to do? I feel like I want to do something. Did I, you know, put two and two together and say, okay, self, think about these stories that you've been telling for almost the last decade. You know, what would these women do? What did they do? And so I really, you know, had to, you know, this, what I just said about building something step by step was something that I almost had to remind myself that was the story that I've told multiple times. And so I really have tried to tell other people, you know, this is where the same people who were building those own movements, this is where they began. And this is where we begin, that we could always learn more, even though, you know, we had a better sense perhaps of history that we've learned in school. I think in a lot of ways we learned a very American focused history, you know, for a lot of reasons. But now the number of people who said, oh, I didn't realize that Italy was under German occupation. I didn't realize the stories of these women during the war. And I thought, yeah, that's right. I didn't know this either until I started doing this research, even though my My grandparents were Italian. Mm-hmm. And so to think of all the stories in history we don't know and what we could learn by, you know, learning, reading about this history and informing ourselves and applying it to today, I think is really, really powerful.
Is that what you hope readers, especially young women, take away from Women of War, that awakening?
Certainly, yes. And to think that you could come from, not feeling like you have power. I think that sense of agency is something that struck me with all of these women and so many others whose stories didn't really make the page, is that they, all of them had this particular moment where, you know, they were doing something because it felt like it was the right thing to do, which is definitely a reason to act, for sure. And then there was a moment when they realized that their actions had this larger implication and that it could help them reimagine their future. And so what they were doing, yes, it was important at the time and they knew that, but they also were doing something for them and for others like them to help create this future. Because they were fighting against fascism in their own country. They wanted a future where they felt more free, where they had more opportunity. And so once they had that realization, it was like they were all in. And all four of them, they didn't know each other, but they all talked about that same feeling of suddenly they felt power for the first time in their lives. And even though they were doing these actions that, you know, they could have been caught, they could have been arrested or killed at any moment, they still felt that this was the most exciting and important part of their life, because this is when they felt that they were making real change.
More information about author Suzanne Cope at her website, suzannecope.com. Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm a longtime listener. So happy to be on.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, NPR journalist Emily Feng's Let Only Red Flowers Bloom reveals the personal stories behind China's political control. This is Radio Chatskill.
Their music signals the beginning of Christmas for millions around the world. Tune in for a festival of nine lessons and carols, broadcast live from historic King's College Chapel in Cambridge, England. Daniel Hyde directs the music, which in addition to the familiar carols includes a brand new piece by Grayston Ives. I'm Michael Barone. Join us on Christmas Eve for a festival of nine lessons and carols from American Public Media.
Tonight at 10.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today, we're revisiting some of our favorite author interviews of the past year. In her debut book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom, Identity and Belonging in Xi Jinping's China, NPR journalist Emily Feng offers a deeply human portrait of modern China under the rule of its most powerful leader in decades. In April, she spoke with Patricio Rubio about the stories behind the headlines and the people whose lives define the struggle for identity in a tightly controlled society.
I want to start off with the title of the book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom. What does it mean and how did you arrive to it?
The title is a reference to a slogan from 1950s China during Chairman Mao's period, where he says at one point, let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools of thought contend. And he wanted to hear dissenting ideas. And then very quickly, he changes his mind. And infamously, if you study modern Chinese history, he clamps down on everyone who was just spoken out and describes it later as a bit of a trap. That phrase, though, has become often repeated in China, in Chinese. And when I was interviewing one of the characters who ended up becoming someone big in the book, they said to me, when describing their predicament, they had been a publisher before, but now we're facing increasing political constraints in China. They said to me in Mandarin, before the state wanted all kinds of flowers, but now the state will only let red flowers bloom. Making an allusion, of course, to that Mao era slogan of letting 100 flowers bloom. And that stuck with me. It was the working title for the book when I was writing it. Thought about changing it at one point. I never did. So that's the title of the book.
Now you open up with a tense moment at the Beijing's airport that you were stopped there. And you describe the sort of the process that you go through when traveling to and from China. What was going through your mind at that moment, and how did that experience really shape the book?
China has been closing the space for civil liberties, for journalism, both for foreign correspondents and for Chinese journalists. And the trends were starting basically from the moment that I moved to China in mid-2015. Looking back, I realize now I moved to China literally the week after something called the 705 lawyers crackdown, where about 300 human rights lawyers, people who are working on serious legal reform cases, highly influential, were suddenly arrested and detained, and in the years since, they've been disbarred or imprisoned. So I moved to China at the beginning of a period of closing down. Previously, there had been decades of opening up politically. And I was covering the Hong Kong protests in 2019 to early 2020. And increasingly, as I left mainland China and was going to Hong Kong and then coming back from Hong Kong to mainland China, I was getting stopped at the airport. And I describe one of these experiences in the Beijing airport coming back from Hong Kong. And so basically all signs were pointing to the fact that not only was reporting in China becoming more difficult, the overall space for freedom of expression, for any kind of critical thought, really, in independent organizing was shrinking. And I might be facing a future pretty soon where I might not be allowed to live and report in China. And so I started thinking about ways to continue to report on China and keep my connection to this country, which I still very much care about, alive, even if I couldn't be there. And that is, unfortunately, what ended up happening in 2020 when I left for a vacation and I was not allowed to go back as an NPR correspondent. So I moved to neighboring Taiwan. But that's when I started writing the book. But the book really came about as a way to think about reporting on China, as increasingly not just me, but other journalists are not able to be on the ground there.
How did your reporting process shift when you could no longer be on the ground in China? And what challenges did that present?
Most of the reporting for the book I had done already before I left China. And part of the book takes us outside of the People's Republic of China. So it brings us to Hong Kong, then it brings us to Taiwan, my home for the last 2 years. And then the book ends with questions of identity and politics among the Chinese diaspora who are living in the U.S. And so I wanted to think about reporting on China as a global project, not just one that you have to do on the ground in China, but examining, for example, the influence that China has economically, culturally, politically, is now global. It's certainly regional in the Asia Pacific, but I think it reaches to Europe, to North America, in both good and bad, productive and unproductive ways. And these questions of Chinese identity, how China sees itself, how it's constructing a more Communist Party-centric identity, that's happening not just in China itself, but we're seeing the ripple effects around the world. So the book broadens what I think is possible in reporting on China, making it a global story, but also decentering Chinese identity as something that's not just happening within the People's Republic of China, this political entity, but something that's happening all over the world.
Now, how did you choose whose stories to tell in the book? You follow a couple of people in the book and tell their stories, but how was that decision made?
I wanted to broadly interpret identity. So I profile characters who, through their lives and through their eyes, you get a sense of issues like gender, language, ethnicity, but also maybe less obvious aspects of identity, political values and visions for the country. Visions for how China should develop economically. It's nominally a socialist country that basically has no tie whatsoever to actual communism. It's a highly capitalistic, highly unequal society. But through individual people and their lived experience, show how there have always been a diversity of opinion, of identity, of different types of people who have existed in China, how even the project of China as an empire and now a modern nation state has always been contested, and that's a strength, not a weakness.
You mentioned a love for a country despite repression. Can you talk about sort of the emotional contradiction, like missing China while being banned from it?
I describe China like it was an abusive ex-partner or something. You both have nostalgia for it, but at the same time, in some respects, it's treated you really, really badly. But that's the allure of China, you know, going back to explorers who were trying to trek into China when its borders were closed, to traders and would-be colonizers who were trying to break into the China market back when it was illegal to teach non-Chinese people Chinese. China's always in some ways been this closed off civilization that people on the outside have a fascination with. And obviously I have a personal tie. My parents were born and raised in China. They were first generation immigrants to the US. And so I straddle these two worlds of both being an American and identifying quite strongly with Chinese culture, but not with the political project that is modern day China. And I wanted to show all those ambiguities and also If you're not a China watcher, you don't keep up with news about China, that's fine. I hope that the characters in this book are entertaining, dramatic, scintillating to read about, because they are people and they've been through some pretty tragic, dramatic, extreme stories that I think will illuminate the human condition no matter who you are.
What conversation do you hope this book starts among readers in the U.S. or elsewhere who may not see how these identity policies in China affect the world?
First of all, I think identity is central to many of the main policies that we've seen come out of China. So this emphasis on national security, on these draconian ethnic policies on minorities in regions like Xinjiang, for example, in Western China that have hit the mainstream news, that ultimately comes down to concerns with consolidating Chinese identity and excluding people who don't fit that definition. But I also hope that when people read this book, they realize China is not a monolith, that the Chinese people are not a cohesive entity. They're not all alike. There's, in fact, extraordinary range in the languages and the identities and the politics and viewpoints of 1.3 billion people living in China, many of whom don't fit in with how the state defines its aims and what it means to be a good Chinese citizen. And so in the context of, say, U.S. politics, when we're thinking about, for example, there's now a House bill in the House of Representatives to ban all Chinese students from getting visas to study in the U.S., is that productive to think about an entire group of people and dealing with them in the same way, when in fact there's huge organic diversity in the people who are born and raised in the People's Republic of China?
You're a reporter, obviously award-winning reporter for NPR. How was the process of doing your job as a reporter and also writing this book at the same time?
I like writing, so it was fun for me. I don't know if I'd feel that way with another book project. Honestly, writing the book was kind of like therapy. I had just sold the book when I found out that I was not going to be able to go back to China after what I thought was a vacation. And I'd lived in China for 7 years at that point. And my work is very important to me. So it was a huge blow in terms of work, in terms of purpose, in terms of my personal life, in terms of my identity, to not be able to go back in the interim as a journalist to this country that I invested so much time in. And I ended up writing most of the book in Taiwan. And it made me realize that my time in China, although it was cut short, was meaningful. I met people who I will never forget. Their stories stay with me, and that's why I wanted to put them in this book.
Now, as China becomes more closed off to foreign reporters, how do you think international understanding of China is changing or being distorted?
It is becoming flatter and more shallow. So we still have foreign reporters who are based there. And there are a lot of Chinese journalists, of course, who cover their own country. But for the former, they're so stretched thin. There are fewer and fewer foreign correspondents in China, especially for American media, because the Chinese government is not giving us visas. And so if you had to pick and choose, you only have time to cover the news stories. You don't have time to take 4 weeks off to do a long form report or an investigative report, because you have maybe a fourth of the headcount that you had, even compared to 5 or 6 years ago. For Chinese journalists, they have faced so much political constraints and censorship that it's very, very hard for them to do independent reporting, even though there are very talented and motivated people who want to do that reporting. It just doesn't see the light of day. Meanwhile, China can pick up an American newspaper, they can listen to your radio station, they can go onto the NPR website, and they can learn everything they want about the U.S. because we still have a free press. And so there's an enormous information asymmetry where they know a lot about us because we write about ourselves, we are often self-critical, and we don't have that access in China. And I still report on China from outside of China, but it's not the same as being on the ground. There were so many stories where I didn't know if I could get information or talk to people. It was only by going to a place physically and testing out my luck and running into people and through them finding more people that I ended up being able to report the story. And that's happening less and less.
You know, now that you're outside of China, how has your sort of your understanding of the country evolved? And what do you hope readers will take away about its people?
I'm missing context. I'm sure I could do more sound-rich stories, more human-centered stories if I were there. And also, honestly, the news appetite has shifted. There is so much happening in the U.S. that I think if you're a journalist working for an American outlet, a lot of the focus has to be on what's happening in the U.S. and as it relates to American politics. And that's further diminished editorial appetite for something more long form, not necessarily news driven from China. It's harder to ask for that space to do something about people in China simply because they're interesting, not because they have anything to do with the U.S.-China relationship, unfortunately.
Right. Now, I know we're running out of time here, but I just want to ask you about some of the stories in the book. You have stories about Hong Kong protesters, Inner Mongolian teachers. I want to see how that sort of connects to the broader story of China's global ambitions.
China has regional ambitions. It would like to be the superpower within the Asia Pacific. And it's very, very annoyed that the U.S. is basically a Pacific superpower as well because of our military and economic projection. For Hong Kong, that is a legacy of this colonial trauma with the two opium wars that the British and various allies, including the U.S., fought and won and wrested extremely unfair concessions from China in the 1800s. And so getting Hong Kong under Chinese communist control has been a chip on Beijing's shoulder. But it's also, the way that Hong Kong has been mismanaged over the last few decades under Beijing's rule. At the time, many Hong Kongers felt Chinese when they were given over to Chinese control. They did not feel British. They felt like British colonial subjects, but they very much identified with the Chinese nation building project. But the Communist Party has so mismanaged that that's created these groundswells of dissent against Beijing. And why has Beijing been so heavy-handed with Hong Kong? I think it ultimately comes down to identity. It's this idea of trying to mold what is a uniquely Hong Kong set of values into the party project of what China should be, making it like any other Chinese city, letting mainland people go and buy houses there and move there when it's even hard for a Hong Konger to buy an apartment. That's created these economic issues that has then engendered these protests that has then given Beijing an excuse to crack down even more legally and politically. That give you an idea, I think, of the often very inflexible and reactionary way that the Communist Party rules that creates more problems for itself often down the road. I don't think that what Beijing did in Hong Kong necessarily applies to any of its global ambitions, but it does give you a sense of their decision-making process. There is no tolerance for risk, for any kind of openness, because they would rather clamp down and have absolute control and kill off innovation and dynamism in the process than to risk letting that happen, but also risk any kind of dissent.
Right. Now, you end the book reflecting on the different ideas of what China means to different people. Now, you now living outside of China, what does being Chinese mean to you?
That's a very good question. And I think it differs from various people who self-identify as Chinese in some way. First of all, I identify as Chinese culturally because I've spent a lot of time learning and speaking Mandarin. But not all people who self-identify as Chinese speak Mandarin. There are quite literally hundreds of Chinese languages out there. Mandarin is a semi-artificial dialect, basically, that people have standardized and used as the common language so that people can communicate, because otherwise our dialects and languages are too different. So for me, it's because I identify with the language, with my family ancestry, with the land that they came from, and with the ongoing struggle to make sure that this place that I come from, the people there live better lives. That's going to be different for someone who maybe identifies as Chinese in Hong Kong, who are speaking Cantonese, which is a completely separate language that I don't understand a word of, even though I speak Mandarin. Or for someone, the rare person in Taiwan these days who still identifies as culturally Chinese. There's not many of them, but they're there. They might speak Hokkien or Hakka, which I also don't understand a word of, even though I speak Mandarin Chinese. So I think there's just a huge diversity of Chinese identities, all of which are equally valid. But for me, I identify with a certain type of Chinese identity. And I am open to other people who think so too, but might look, act, and dress differently than me.
We're talking to NPR journalist Emily Fang about her new book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom. Thank you so much for talking to me. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, how did Amelia Earhart become one of the most enduring icons of the 20th century? Award-winning journalist Lori Gwynn Shapiro traces the bold partnership between Earhart and George Putnam, the showman who helped amplify her legend. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Bursting colors, heartfelt drama, and sizzling action. Animated movies are magical, no matter how old you are. And this year marks the 40th anniversary of Japan's Studio Ghibli. We'll celebrate with the music of Joe Hisaishi, the composer who brings these films to life.
Coming up tonight at 9 on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today, we're looking back at some of our favorite author interviews of the past year. In September, I spoke with award-winning journalist and author Lori Gwynn Shapiro about her book, The Aviator and the Showman. In it, Shapiro uncovers the bold partnership of aviator Amelia Earhart and publishing impresario George Putnam, a marriage that fused love, ambition, and risk while shaping Earhart into one of the most enduring cultural icons of the 20th century. What made now the right moment for you to revisit her life and legacy?
I think one of the things I should start off by saying is that I began this project thinking, why me? Just your question. But I think that was, I have done stories of lost history. I write often for the New York Times, for the, I've had online before on the New Yorker. My book was just excerpted in the New Yorker in print, which was a thrill. But I had that moment of, can I do this? Can you actually take on a story like Amelia Earhart? What new you have to say? And I'm very good at researching. I'm a journalist. I'm not coming at it as someone who was an aviator. I can barely drive a car because I'm a native New Yorker. I'm not someone who, I mean, I do love Amelia Earhart. When I was growing up, my first book that I received that was a biography was an Amelia Earhart book that I picked out of the Scholastic Flyer. I always thought she's a hero. And I want to say up front that after I finished 5 years of working on this book, I still think she's a hero. But I think that the truth of how she rose to fame is very complicated. And you do not get Amelia Earhart without George Palmer Putnam, who was her lover and then her husband, who shaped her career. And perhaps together they were responsible for her death. And I think that was what was most important was finding the archives to prove my theory, which took a long time, but the research paid off.
and you focus on that partnership with Amelia and George Palmer Putnam. He was a publishing impresario, a showman, her husband. How did that partnership shape the Amelia Earhart we think we know today?
Well, Amelia Earhart had flown before she met Putnam. She meets him in New York City in April of 1928. And she is being cast in a way, it's almost the first reality show. There's Putnam had been the publisher for Lindbergh, and he had a lot of power because of that. He was also Admiral Richard Byrd's publisher. And at the end of the 20s, the aviators were the gods. They were the rock stars. But no one really cared about who's the next solo person across the Atlantic once you have that accomplishment. And what Putnam was interested in is how can he make money off of books? And a lot of women wanted to have that glory. And one of them was a very wealthy woman named Amy Phipps Guest, who wanted to go across. She was steel heiress, the Phipps family. And her family in New York said, you're out of your mind, Mom. You're not going across the Atlantic. And it was through her money that she agreed to find a wholesome replacement to mirror Charles Lindbergh. And Byrd's client was, Byrd's publisher was Putnam, and Byrd gave this tip off to Putnam, and he secretly started to cast around because he thought he had this exclusive. So basically, the first time she's going across and she is cast, she's a passenger. She's not even touching the flight anything. I mean, she's like in the back, but she gets a ticker tape parade, and that's her first amount of fame. And the men that flew across, nobody really cared about them. There was a woman that went across the Atlantic, but she, that really bothered her, and she really wanted to cross the Atlantic by herself, which, as all Amelia Earhart fans would know, she did in 1932. She crossed the Atlantic by herself. But to fly across the Atlantic, to do flight at that time cost a lot of money, and you needed promotion. And P.T. Barnum had nothing on G.P. Putnam, let me tell you. I mean, he really was a man. He did things that are unbelievable. And I'm not actually, as I go through the archives and I'm listening to hundreds of hours of tapes that no one has listened to, of people that knew both G.P. and Amelia very, very well, people that are in my book, who had written their words before actually hearing tapes. And then once I got a hold of the tapes I was looking for, I was able to really go deeper and really flesh out this narrative. But, you know, Putnam wasn't the nicest guy in the world. I'm going to just say that. Amelia was. Amelia was. But, you know, sometimes, you know, he was her bully, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's interesting. I mean, why can't we tell the truth that, you know, like, that's what a journalist does. You try to make people into full-fledged human beings and not iconic images. And, you know, Amelia Earhart can mess up. Amelia Earhart can be ambitious. I mean, we don't allow our women heroes to be blatantly ambitious.
They called Amelia Earhart Lady Lindy, a nickname after her first flight across the Atlantic, because she kind of, she flew across the Atlantic like Lindbergh, but she kind of looked like Lindbergh, according to some. But that was a nickname that you found out kind of constrained her as well as elevating her. What did you learn about how these myths are manufactured for these famous, iconic people?
Well, Lady Lindbergh comes directly from George Putnam and his colleague, Hilton Raley, who was another PR guru of the time. And they, I mean, even she had cut her hair for the 20s, but she had more of a bob. They even had her cut her hair to look more like Lindbergh and had paintings where, you know, of her made before she even had crossed the Atlantic, ready to go if she made it, where they're basically angling her to look like Lindbergh. But at the end, Amelia Earhart actually, who had a picture of Lindbergh in her bedroom, like many people did, eventually she gets to know Lindbergh, and she's friends with Anne Morrow Lindbergh, you know, Lindbergh's wife, and she's terribly embarrassed by this. But this is all part of the PR, is sort of like, you know, imagine any celebrity today, you know, there's things that are planted so that you start to follow their career. But I will say that George Putnam, although I don't love him at the end of researching this book, and I do love Amelia, I will say you have to give him credit for tremendous innovations. Like, he had books with records at the end of the book, you know, of Amelia crossing the Atlantic, the radio announcements. It actually, I should say, since I'm on radio, that radio plays a very big part in the promotion in the jazz age. And I think it's amazing that radio is still vibrant today. and newspapers as well. It weren't just like the New York Times. There were, you know, there would be 17, 18 newspapers in New York City alone. Imagine that, all over the country. And she was a national hit and then an international hit before she even landed across the Atlantic. I mean, the promotion machine was ginormous. It was the era of hullabaloo.
In your earlier book, The Stowaway, you uncovered the story of a forgotten teenager who snuck onto an Antarctic expedition. How does your background as a documentarian and detective-like researcher inform the way you uncover these hidden histories?
Well, for that book, which, by the way, that was my connective tissue to this book, because it was a stowaway on Richard Byrd's trip to Antarctica, and I did so much research that I actually found the wife of the stowaway. And through that access, I was able to really get a real human being. It would, you know, otherwise the stowaway would have been one paragraph. I mean, to get the wife of the youngest person on America's first expedition, she was sleeping next to him for 40 years. I was able to get her. She's no longer alive. But I also went to Antarctica. I mean, I don't play.
You're serious.
and even on the Amelia Earhart research, I don't just go by the one archive that everyone knows, which is Purdue University, where George Putnam donated a lot of Amelia Earhart archives right after she died in 1937. And he was getting remarried to a very young woman within the year, and she didn't want to live with a ghost. But Purdue has a lot. And then Harvard University has a tremendous collection through Radcliffe. Her sister gave stuff there. But that's what everybody picks over. But when you do a popular book, my book is published by Viking Penguin. So I got a pretty nice advance. But much to my husband's chagrin, I used a lot of my advance to go places. And I went to 30 states. And I went through archives. And I also tracked down grandchildren and children. And I'm trying to triangulate the truth, looking at archives that no one else has ever used. What is off record? What hasn't been seen? I even went to Newfoundland, where Amelia Earhart flew from on her first two famous flights, and where a lot of people would cross the Atlantic from Newfoundland because it was the closest spot on the other side of from North America to Europe. And I was there for 2 weeks, and I was able to meet the people that hosted Amelia Earhart, the grandchildren of the people who hosted Amelia Earhart. And they're pulling out archives like, you know, family scrapbooks that no one's ever seen. You really have to get off your chair. You have to get off the Zoom and really do, like, you know, reporting. I mean, that's what reporting is actually going deeper than anyone else.
Before we go, what do you hope folks take away from this craft of reporting and sleuthing and telling someone else's story?
People want real lives. I don't think we want just icons. I mean, I remember somebody saying, you know, I would never say anything bad about Amelia Earhart. Why not? I mean, are we perfect human beings? I think that when you trust the person doing the reporting, the story feels deeper because it is deeper. I mean, there's so many books that I've read about Amelia Earhart where she's just a perfect human being and she doesn't have anger and she doesn't smoke and she's not malicious. I mean, who among us can say we're perfect human beings? And I think that that's what good biography is. I'm also in a genre that might be called narrative nonfiction, where it's all true. My notes are in the back, but it feels more like a story, like cinematic. And if you're a fan of David Gran, like The Wager or Patrick Radden Keefe, those are the kind of stories that I'm trying to write. Not just a soup to nuts biography, but make you feel like you're in this world. And by going to these places, I'm actually able to, you know, give us a sense of place. There's no reason that nonfiction can't have characters and plot and drama. It doesn't have to be dry. And that's what I hope you find. There's a real person. And therefore, the story hopefully becomes much more intriguing.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, cookbook author Alison Roman. This is Radio Chatskill.
Since 1770, musicians of historic Trinity Church have inspired concertgoers with their interpretation of Handel's oratorio Messiah. It wouldn't be Christmas time without it. Hear this holiday favorite sung by the choir of Trinity Church and played on period instruments under the direction of Andrew McGill. Handel's Messiah from Trinity Church.
Tonight at midnight on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today, we're bringing you some of our favorite author interviews of the past year. Known for her candid cooking style and approachable yet elevated recipes, Alison Roman has built a career through cookbooks like Dining In, Nothing Fancy, and Sweet Enough. Her fourth, Something from Nothing, was released in November. Erin Shearer spoke to her last month about her new book and her Bloomville store, First Bloom, in Delaware County, for her series Eating Upstate.
Alison Roman first became acquainted with Delaware County during the writing and publication process of her first cookbook, Dining In, published in 2017. While she was there, she dined at places like Brushland Eating House, featured on Eating Upstate in 2022, and the now-shuttered pizza restaurant Table on 10, located in Bloomville.
Yeah, we were introduced first by a friend of mine who has a house in Andes when I was shooting Dining In up there, because I just rented an Airbnb. And I asked him, do you know anyone like where I could get fish when I'm up there? And he said, well, you could ask Sohail, who owns Special Needing House. I can introduce you. And so he introduced us and we sort of became friendly from there, and then just became closer. And yeah, I love them so much and I love their restaurant so much. And it's such a wonderful place to have in the community. And I think they're so influential on how many people have decided to move up there and like pursue their dreams, especially in the food space. They're great. I love them so much.
Like many New York City residents in the year 2020, Allison Roman found herself looking for a house in upstate New York. She struggled to find a home within her price range. However, while she was looking for a house, she discovered that the building that had housed Table on 10 was up for sale. Table on 10 closed at the beginning of the pandemic, and its owners, Inez and Justice Kempthorne, had decided to put the building up for sale to focus on their Airbnb properties.
Well, I mean, I think it mostly comes down to what I could afford. And it's no secret that property in the Catskills is a bit cheaper than Manhattan or the Hamptons or Brooklyn. And I think just for me at the time, I was single and was sort of looking for a place that I could put roots down, regardless of if I got married one day or where the wind blew me. I just was like ready for something, and buying property within New York City or Brooklyn felt impossible and remains to feel impossible. But so I thought, okay, well, I can buy this building and I can stay there while I renovate it to be a store one day. And so slowly sort of was able to take my time. And I thought, okay, well, if I own the property that the grocery store is in, then I don't have to pay rent. So then that's affordable. I don't owe anyone money as a land, you know, I'm my own landlord. And if it doesn't work out, I can always Airbnb it. Like I felt like I had a bunch of options, but ultimately it was sort of like the right place, right time. And that specific property became available. I wasn't looking to open a grocery store in the area necessarily. I was looking for a house, and I was sort of like almost immediately following the pandemic priced out because everybody started moving, and you know, I just wasn't in the bracket to afford the houses that I was looking at. And but somehow this place, Table on 10, came on the market, and I thought, wow, like that could be the exact solution that I, a single person who one day dreams of opening a grocery store, this could be that place. And it turned out to be, I think, just right.
Roman purchased the building in February 2021. After purchasing the property, Roman spent time trying to figure out the best use for the space. She considered many options, including a wine bar and an Airbnb, before settling on opening a grocery store.
Well, I think that because I had never done this before, I had never owned my own business in this way, I didn't really know what to expect. And I think that because I also had like, I wanted it to be flexible. I wanted it to be like, okay, well, maybe it'll be a wine bar. Maybe it'll be a this, maybe it'll be a that. And I needed to kind of sit in the space, spend more time in the area and figure out like what was actually going to be realistic and attainable. And like also service the community, like what was going to be like the best thing for everyone, I think. Even though I think everyone wants pizza back. And I said very early on, I said, oh, I'm never opening a pizza restaurant. But, you know, I think that it would be very difficult to probably operate a grocery store and like pay rent and figure out how to make that work as a business, because I don't pay myself a salary for this project. So I basically save the money by not paying myself and not paying rent. And you know, it's easy to sustain the business that way. It becomes very affordable when you own the property.
First Bloom opened on Labor Day weekend 2023. The opening of First Bloom coincided with another major event in Roman's life, getting married.
It was overwhelming. Yeah, it was my hope that we were going to open in May, but we didn't end up opening until Labor Day. So it wasn't the intention to open at the same time as I was getting married, but it is sort of just how it happened. And the alternative was to like push the opening to October because I was going on a honeymoon and the wedding. It was like, it just felt like it was sort of now or never. And we were ready. So it didn't feel necessary to hold the date just to like, you know, but yeah, it was crazy. It was totally not something I recommend. But, you know, a lot of people I know that open restaurants or bars or stores, you know, they have like a baby at the same time, or they're moving apartments at the same time, or, you know, life events tend to cluster together for whatever reason. And it's just like the way the universe unfolds sometimes. But yeah, it was pretty hectic. But we got through it.
First Bloom carries pantry items from brands like Burlap and Barrel, as well as their own brand. They carry bread from Cafe Mootsie and Andy's, and source their produce from Somewhere in Time Farm, located in Parksville, as well as farms connected to the 607 CSA based in nearby Hamden.
Pantry essentials. What are my favorite pantry? Like, what do I deem essential? And I think that's like, because it's not a price chopper, it is my store. It is somewhat curated. There's certain things I don't carry, but like, you know, there's ingredients that I don't care for that I still have. I don't love ketchup. We carry ketchup, Heinz. And it's the same price as Price Chopper. And, you know, but it is like, okay, what do I consider to be the best version of this ingredient? We're going to carry that one. And sometimes it's what's the best and what's the most affordable, and we'll carry both because I want people to have the option. But yeah, I would say that, like, for sure, they both sort of informed each other weirdly.
Owning and operating First Bloom and Roman's time upstate also served as the inspiration for her new cookbook, Something from Nothing. It features recipes previously featured on Home Movies, the web series hosted by Roman, shot on the upper floor of the First Bloom building.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think just being upstate did, honestly, because I went from being in New York, where like anytime I wanted any ingredient, I could just walk out of the house and in within 10 minutes have it and be back in my apartment cooking with it. And when you're upstate, you have to get in the car, you got to drive to the store, you got to get in the store, you got to leave the store, you got to come back. And it's like a whole thing. And especially if it's the winter or the weather's bad, you're like, I don't want to do all that. So there was or they're closed. And, you know, there were a lot of times where I was like, I only have, you know, a can of beans, like half a bunch of old kale, a pack of frozen chicken, and like an old lemon. Or whatever, like, and that's all I have, you know? So I think that being upstate really did force me to cook differently and to think about ingredients differently, because I didn't have access to like the beautiful fresh produce at a moment's notice. I just couldn't go like get my favorite dairy products whenever I wanted. So in a way that informed me opening the store, but also then opening the store informed my cooking.
To learn more about Allison Roman's new cookbook, Something from Nothing, visit her website at allisoneroman.com. First Bloom is located at 52030 State Route 10 in Bloomville. I'm Erin Shear. Eating Upstate is a production of Radio Catskill.
That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeffersonville Bake Shop, open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks. Also featuring olive oil, ceramics, and other handmade items by artists and makers in Palestine.
Hi, I'm Kathy Geary, host of Now and Then. I just want to wish you and your family a Happy New Year. From all of us here at WJFF, thank you for listening. Have a safe and festive holiday season and a happy new year.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6, right after All Things Considered. The local edition.
We believe nonpartisan, nonprofit news is essential to a healthy community. And as a Radio Catskill listener, we're guessing you feel the same way. We deliver fact-based journalism that holds the powerful accountable and keeps our community informed. Every story we produce is powered by listeners like you. And right now, through December 31st, your gift to Radio Catskill will be matched dollar for dollar up to $1,000 by Newsmatch. Support local news and information. Give now at wjffradio.org. Thank you.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.